Chapter 42. Marlowe emerged out of the shadow of the bookcase to get himself a cigar from a box which stood on a little table by my side. In the full light of the room I saw in his eyes that slightly mocking expression with which he habitually covers up his sympathetic impulses of mirth and pity before the unreasonable complications the idealism of mankind puts into the simple, but poignant, problem of conduct on this earth. He selected and lit the cigar with affected care, then turned upon me. I had been looking at him silently. "I suppose," he said, the mockery of his eyes giving a pellucid quality to his tone, "that you think it's high time I told you something definite. I mean something about that psychological cabin mystery of discomfort, for it's obvious that it must be psychological, which affected so profoundly Mr. Franklin the chief mate, and had even disturbed the serene innocence of Mr. Powell, the second of the ship Ferndale, commanded by Roderick Anthony the son of the poet, you know. You are going to confess now that you have failed to find it out," I said in pretended indignation. "It would serve you right if I told you that I have. But I won't. I haven't failed. I own though that for a time, I was puzzled. However, I have now seen our Powell many times under the most favorable conditions, and besides I came upon a most unexpected source of information. But never mind that. The means don't concern you except in so far as they belong to the story. I'll admit that for some time the old maiden lady-like occupation of putting two and two together failed to procure a coherent theory. I am speaking now as an investigator, a man of deductions. With what we know of Roderick Anthony and Florida Barrel, I could not deduct an ordinary marital quarrel beautifully matured in less than a year, could I? If you ask me, what is an ordinary marital quarrel, I will tell you that it is a difference about nothing. I mean, these nothings which, as Mr. Powell told us, when we first met him, sure people are so prone to start a row about, and nurse into hatred from an idle sense of wrong, from perverted ambition, for spectacular reasons too. There are on earth no actors too humble, and obscure not to have a gallery, that gallery which envenoms the play by stealthy jeers, counsels of anger, amused comments or words of perfidious compassion. However, the Anthonys were free from all demoralizing influences. At sea, you know, there is no gallery. You hear no tormenting echoes of your own littleness there, where either a great elemental voice roars defiantly under the sky, or else an elemental silence seems to be part of the infinite stillness of the universe. Remembering Florida Barrel in the depths of moral misery, and Roderick Anthony carried away by a gust of tempestuous tenderness, I asked myself, is it all forgotten already? What could they have found to estrange them from each other with this rapidity, and this thoroughness so far from all temptations, in the peace of the sea, and in an isolation so complete, that if it had not been the jealous devotion of the sentimental Franklin stimulating the attention of Powell, there would have been no record, no evidence of it at all. I must confess at once, that it was Florida Barrel whom I suspected. In this world, as at present organized, women are the suspected half of the population. There are good reasons for that. These reasons are so discoverable with a little reflection, that it is not worth my while to set them out for you. I will only mention this, that the part falling to women's share being all influence has an air of occult and mysterious action, something not altogether trustworthy like all natural forces which, for us, work in the dark, because of our imperfect comprehension. If women were not a force of nature, blind in its strength and capricious in its power, they would not be mistrusted. As it is, one can't help it. You will say, that this force having been in the person of Florida Barrel captured by Anthony. Why yes. He had dealt with her masterfully. But man has captured electricity too. It lights him on his way, it warms his home, it will even cook his dinner for him very much like a woman. But what sort of conquest would you call it? He knows nothing of it. He has got to be mighty careful what he is about with his captive. And the greater the demand he makes on it in the exaltation of his pride, the more likely it is to turn on him, and burn him to a cinder. A far-fetched enough parallel, I observed coldly to Marlowe. He had returned to the armchair in the shadow of the bookcase. But accepting the meaning you have in your mind, it reduces itself to the knowledge of how to use it. And if you mean that this ravenous Anthony ravenous is good, interrupted Marlowe. He was a hungering and a thirsting for femininity to enter his life in a way no mere feminist could have the slightest conception of. I reckon that this accounts for much of Fine's disgust with him. Good little Fine. You have no idea what infernal mischief he had worked during his call at the hotel. But then who could have suspected Anthony of being a heroic creature? There are several kinds of heroism, and one of them at least is idiotic. It is the one which wears the aspect of sublime delicacy. It is apparently the one of which the son of the delicate poet was capable. He certainly resembled his father, who, by the way, wore out two women without any satisfaction to himself, because they did not come up to his super-refined standard of the delicacy which is so perceptible in his verses. That's your poet. He demands too much from others. The inarticulate son had set up a standard for himself with that need for embodying in his conduct the dreams, the passion, the impulses the poet puts into arrangements of verses, which are dearer to him than his own self, and may make his own self appear sublime in the eyes of other people, and even in his own eyes. Did Anthony wish to appear sublime in his own eyes? I should not like to make that charge. Though indeed there are other, less noble, ambitions at which the world does not dare to smile. But I don't think so. I do not even think that there was in what he did a conscious and lofty confidence in himself, a particularly pronounced sense of power which leads men so often into impossible or equivocal situations. Looked at abstractedly, the way in which truth is often seen in its real shape, his life had been a life of solitude and silence and desire. Chance had thrown that girl in his way, and if we may smile at his violent conquest of Florida Barrel, we must admit also that this eager appropriation was truly the act of a man of solitude and desire, a man also who, unless a complete imbecile, must have been a man of long and ardent reveries wherein the faculty of sincere passion matures slowly in the unexplored recesses of the heart. And I know also that a passion, dominating or tyrannical, invading the whole man and subjugating all his faculties to its own unique end, may conduct him whom it spurs and drives into all sorts of adventures, to the brink of unfathomable dangers, to the limits of folly, and madness, and death. To the man then of a silence made only more impressive by the inarticulate thunders and mutters of the great seas, an utter stranger to the clatter of tongues, there comes the muscular little Fine, the most marked representative of that mankind whose voice is so strange to him, the husband of his sister, a personality standing out from the misty and remote multitude. He comes and throws at him more talk than he had ever heard boomed out in an hour, and certainly touching the deepest things Anthony had ever discovered in himself, and flings words like unfair whose very sound is abhorrent to him. Unfair. Undue advantage. He. Unfair to that girl? Cruel to her. No scorn could stand against the impression of such charges advanced with heat and conviction. They shook him. They were yet vibrating in the air of that stuffy hotel room, terrific, disturbing, impossible to get rid of, when the door opened and Florida Barrel entered. He did not even notice that she was late. He was sitting on a sofa plunged in gloom. Was it true? Having himself always said exactly what he meant, he imagined that people, unless they were liars, which of course his brother-in-law could not be, never said more than they meant. The deep chest voice of Little Fine was still in his ear. He knows, Anthony said to himself. He thought he had better go away and never see her again. But she stood there before him accusing and appealing. How could he abandon her? That was out of the question. As he had no one. Or rather, as he had someone. That father. Anthony was willing to take him at evaluation. This father may have been the victim of the most atrocious injustice. But what could a man coming out of jail do? An old man too. And then what sort of man? What would become of them both? Anthony shuddered slightly, and the faint smile with which Flora had entered the room faded on her lips. She was used to his impetuous tenderness. She was no longer afraid of it. But as he had never seen him look like this before, and she suspected at once some new cruelty of life. He got up with his usual ardor, but as if sobered by a momentous resolve and said, "No. I can't let you out of my sight. I have seen you. You have told me your story. You are honest. You have never told me you loved me." She waited, saying to herself that he had never given her time, that he had never asked her. And that, in truth, she did not know. I am inclined to believe that she did not. As abundance of experience is not precisely her lot in life, a woman is seldom an expert in matters of sentiment. It is the man who can, and generally does, he himself pretty well inside and out. Women's self-possession is an outward thing. Inwardly they flutter, perhaps because they are, or they feel themselves to be, engaged. All this speaking generally. In Flora DeBarrel's particular case, ever since Anthony had suddenly broken his way into her hopeless and cruel existence, she lived like a person liberated from a condemned cell by a natural cataclysm, a tempest, an earthquake. Not absolutely terrified, because nothing can be worse than the eve of execution, but stunned, bewildered, abandoning herself passively. She did not want to make a sound, to move a limb. As he hadn't the strength. What was the good? And deep down, almost unconsciously, she was seduced by the feeling of being supported by this violence. A sensation as he had never experienced before in her life. She felt as if this whirlwind were calming down somehow. As if this feeling of support, which was tempting her to close her eyes deliciously, and let herself be carried on and on into the unknown undefiled by vile experiences, were less certain, had wavered threateningly. She tried to read something in his face, in that energetic kindly face to which as he had become accustomed so soon. But she was not yet capable of understanding its expression. Scared, discouraged on the threshold of adolescence, plunged in moral misery of the bitterest kind, as he had not learned to read, not that sort of language. If Anthony's love had been as egoistic as love generally is, it would have been greater than the egoism of his vanity, or of his generosity, if you like, and all this could not have happened. He would not have hit upon that renunciation at which one does not know whether to grin or shudder. It is true, too, that then his love would not have fastened itself upon the unhappy daughter of DeBarrel. But it was a love born of that rare pity which is not akin to contempt, because rooted in an overwhelmingly strong capacity for tenderness, the tenderness of the fiery kind, the tenderness of silent, solitary men, the voluntary, passionate outcasts of their kind. At the time I am forced to think that his vanity must have been enormous. What big eyes as he has, he said to himself amazed. No wonder. She was staring at him with all the might of her soul awakening slowly from a poisoned sleep, in which it could only quiver with pain, but could neither expand nor move. He plunged into them breathless and tense, deep, deep, like a mad sailor taking a desperate dive from the masthead into the blue unfathomable sea, so many men have execrated and loved at the same time. And his vanity was immense. It had been touched to the quick by that muscular little feminist, "Fine!" Exclamation point I. Take advantage of her helplessness. I. Unfair to that creature, that wisp of mist, that white shadow homeless in an ugly dirty world. I could blow her away with a breath, he was saying to himself with horror. Ever. All the supremely refined delicacy of tenderness, expressed in so many fine lines of verse by Carly and Anthony, grew to the size of a passion filling with inward sobs the big frame of the man who had never in his life read a single one of those famous sonnets singing of the most highly civilized. chivalrous love of those sonnets which... dot dot you know there's a volume of them. My edition has the portrait of the author at 30, and when I showed it to Mr. Powell the other day he exclaimed, "Wonderful! One would think this the portrait of Captain Anthony himself if..." Dot I wanted to know what that if was. But Powell could not say. There was something a difference. No doubt there was in fineness perhaps. The father, fastidious, cerebral, morbidly shrinking from all contacts, could only sing in harmonious numbers of what the son felt with a dumb and reckless sincerity. Possessed by most strong men's touching illusion as to the frailness of women and their spiritual fragility, it seemed to Anthony that he would be destroying, breaking something very precious inside that being. In fact, nothing less than partly murdering her. This seems a very extreme effect to flow from Fine's words. But Anthony, unaccustomed to the chatter of the firm earth, never stayed to ask himself what value these words could have in Fine's mouth. And indeed the mere dark sound of them was utterly abhorrent to his native rectitude, sea-salted, hardened in the winds of wide horizons, open as the day. He wished to blurt out his indignation, but she regarded him with an expectant air which checked him. His visible discomfort made her uneasy. He could only repeat "H.S. You are perfectly honest. You might have, but I dare say you are right. At any rate, you have never said anything to me which you didn't mean." "Never," she whispered after a pause. He seemed distracted, choking with an emotion she could not understand, because it resembled embarrassment, a state of mind inconceivable in that man. She wondered what it was as he had said, remembering that in very truth as he had hardly spoken to him except when giving him the bare outline of her story which he seemed to have hardly had the patience to hear, waving it perpetually aside with exclamations of horror and anger, with fiercely somber mutters, "No! Enough!" and with alarming starts from a forced stillness, as though he meant to rush out at once and take vengeance on somebody. She was saying to herself that he caught her words in the air, never letting her finish her thought. "Honest. Honest. Yes, certainly, yes, he had been that." Her letter to Mrs. Fine had been prompted by honesty. But she reflected sadly that as he had never known what to say to him. That perhaps as he had nothing to say. "But you'll find out that I can be honest too," he burst out in a menacing tone, as he had learned to appreciate with an amused thrill. She waited for what was coming, but he hung in the wind. He looked round the room with disgust, as if he could see traces on the walls of all the casual tenants that had ever passed through it. People had quarreled in that room, they had been ill in it, there had been misery in that room, wickedness, crime perhaps, death most likely. This was not a fit place. He snatched up his hat. He had made up his mind. The ship he had known ever since she came off the stocks, his home or shelter, the uncontaminated honest ship, was the place. "Let us go on board. We'll talk there," he said. "Andy, you will have to listen to me. For whatever happens, no matter what they say, I cannot let you go." "You can't say that, misgivings, or no misgivings, she could have done anything else but go on board." It was the appointed business of Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.